Good morning. Hopefully you guys had a good worship time with Dan and Jen this morning. We're going to get right into our passage this week in Matthew 18. We saw coming into this passage that we're going to look at this morning that Jesus is describing the kingdom of heaven, the citizens of the kingdom of heaven, as those who are childish in a way, who are humble, who are considered foolish by the world's standards, and that we're those people who recognize our vulnerability and our weakness, and are willing to seek help, seek the salvation that we need, that we're willing to receive correction because we recognize our vulnerability and the fact that we at times will need correction by other believers, and to be willing to correct and lovingly go to a brother or sister in Christ and show them their error in order to bring them back to a place of where sin, that sin is not dragging them down, And so we go right into this next picture of Peter coming up to Jesus and asking him a question, which is really like if we're addressing sin in another person's life and trying to love them that way, well, what if that person is sinning against us? In that moment, it's not our responsibility to go and address that sin in their life and hold them accountable like you would in this last passage that we were looking at. But there is an appropriate response in that moment. And that response is forgiveness. And that's what Peter's asking about here in this next section. So he starts it like this. It says, then Peter came and said to Jesus, Lord, how often shall I forgive my brother? How often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times? So the first and most important thing to understand about this passage or the most important word in this passage is forgive, to forgive. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and expansion on this word that occurs. The way we use forgiveness in our world today is pretty accurate, but it gets a little convoluted. The bottom line is the Greek word is a word that just means to let it go. If I was to pick up my water bottle here and then set it down, in a Greek sense, I just forgave my water bottle. I just let it go. I dropped it to the ground. That's the idea here. When someone sins against us, how often should we let it go? And forgiveness is not talking about feeling great about them. It's not like if I forgive them, I've got to feel great about who they are or what they've done. It's not forgetting. You know, we have this idea of like forgiving and forgetting, which is kind of physically impossible unless you have some sort of mental defect. You're not going to forget the experiences that you've had or forget that you experienced wrong by someone. So I think that idea of forgiving and forgetting is kind of fallacious. It's also not denying what has been done. It's not like to forgive someone is to go, oh yeah, it never happened. No, it did happen. But it's to see the wrong that they did and to choose not to hold that wrong against that person. To not let it affect the way that we love them or the way that that we treat them, the way that we continue to serve them in love. And so the question here that comes up is, when should I let it go? And our logic would probably say, well, it kind of depends. Forgiveness, it kind of depends on certain factors. It probably depends on what they've done to you. The nature of what they've done to you. Is it a big offense? Is it a small offense? Or have they have they said that they're sorry? Have they asked for forgiveness? And it seems justified if you know what? If they haven't asked for forgiveness, why would I offer forgiveness? If they haven't said that they're sorry, they're not even sorry for what they did, of course I'm not going to forgive them for that. Or maybe they do say, I'm sorry, and ask for forgiveness, but you don't believe them. They're not believable. And so, yeah, I'm probably not going to offer forgiveness. Because they're just saying that they're sorry to kind of get out of the consequences of what they did. Or, you know what, do they understand what they did? Do they understand the hurt that they've caused? If I let them off the hook, then they'll never feel the gravity or how deeply I've been hurt by this. And so they'll never learn how much that's affected me. So I want them to feel a little bit the way I feel. So I need to maybe punish them a little bit until I'm convinced that they're really sorry, or that they've learned from their mistake, or that they've changed. I'm going to wait until they've changed and then maybe offer them forgiveness. Or maybe until I'm convinced that they won't do it again. And then I can offer forgiveness to them. I read some articles this week by some psychologists talking about, you know, when should you forgive? And a few of the psychologists really hammered this idea of, well, you forgive when it will benefit you. You basically weigh the pros and the cons, and if there's more pros to forgiving the person, like maybe it makes you feel better, or it repairs a relationship that's really important to you, then when there's more pros than cons, yeah, forgive them. But when there's more cons than pros, no, you don't offer forgiveness. Why would you do that? Because the core question is, how does it benefit me? There was actually an article I read that gave five reasons not to forgive. And the first one was an insufficient apology. They haven't apologized sufficiently for me. The second one would be if they're all talk and no action, like they'll say that they're sorry, but they won't act like they're sorry. Yeah, you shouldn't offer forgiveness there. They said maybe it's too early to forgive, that you've got to let it kind of, you got to work through it. You've got to get down the road a little bit before you can forgive them. That maybe that's the best thing for you and for them to keep unforgiveness in your heart for a little while until it's the right time. Or maybe if the apology comes too late, that maybe this is a hurt from years ago and they never apologized for it and you never forgave them for it. And now years later, they're trying to apologize and you're like, it's too late now. Now, if you would apologize to them, maybe I would have forgiven you, but it's too late. Or they said the other reason not to forgive is if it's a pattern of repeat behavior. Maybe you've forgiven them before and forgiven them before and forgiven them before, and they've just run out of their chances now. And so it, really that's the question that Peter's asking here is how many times is it wise to forgive someone? You know, we have that adage, fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice and shame on me, right? I should learn from that. I shouldn't just continue to forgive. And in fact, in the first century, the rabbis were pretty much had a consensus on this, that it was three times, that was the number of times that you should forgive someone, which actually seems very, very logical. I mean, if you can picture this, a very forgiving person might, you know, if your neighbor borrows your truck to go do some work or whatever, and the tank is full when they take it, but when they bring it back, the it's almost on empty. And you wake up the next morning, you don't know. You wake up the next morning, you're headed to work, and you get in the car, and it's almost on empty. And you're like, oh, man, I got to go fill up the tank. So you go fill up the tank, and it actually makes you late for work. And you go to that person, you're like, how could you do that? How could you leave me on empty there? I was late for work. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, can you forgive me? Sure, yeah. I'll forgive you, right? That's a forgiving person that wouldn't hold that against them. But then they ask you again, a couple weeks down the line, hey, can I borrow your truck again? You're a little more reluctant at this point. Yeah, okay, sure, yeah, okay, you can borrow that. And you have a full tank and they bring it back and you don't know it, but they leave it on empty. And this time you actually check and you see that it's on empty. So you have to go and fill it up that night so it's ready for you to go to work tomorrow. And you're irritated by that. And you go to them and you're like, how could you do that again? You told me you were sorry last time. Why wouldn't you leave it full this time? Oh, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And then a month down the road, they're like, hey, can I borrow your truck? And you're like, yeah, you can, but okay, are you going to do what you said last time you were going to do? Yeah, I'll do it. And they take your truck and then they bring it back and again they leave it on empty. That are you going to forgive him that third time? Okay, that's real forgiveness, right, at this point. Because it seems intentional at this point that they're doing this. Or at least they're just super forgetful, and there's no excuse for that. And okay, I'm going to forgive them this last time, but they're never borrowing my truck again. Like, that seems fair. But Peter here is going beyond that. He's like, I'm going beyond what the rabbi said. I've been around you enough, Jesus, that I figure out that you're about forgiveness, right? And grace and mercy. And so he's like, I'm going to you, Jesus. You're not dumb. You're not a pushover. You're a wise guy. And I want to know, is seven? Like, I think Peter's probably thinking, hey, I'm going above and beyond what Jesus would probably say. I'm going to act like I'm more forgiving. Because this is kind of Peter's pattern. Like, he always kind of goes above and beyond, right? So he's like, I'm going to say seven times. Which, if you think about it, is a lot of times to forgive someone a hurt that they've done repeatedly to you. And Jesus responds in a way that I think probably is surprising to Peter and anyone who is listening. And he says this. So Jesus said to them, I do not say to you up to seven times, but 70 times seven. And I actually think the more accurate way to look at the 70 times seven is not 70 times seven like 490, but 70 times and seven. So 77 times. And I don't know which way for sure it is, but honestly, even that discussion misses his point. Because he's not saying 490 times or 77 times, like you're supposed to keep some sort of a log of the times that people have wronged you. And then once you hit that 77th time in your log, well, that 78th time, I'm not going to forgive that. That's not his point at all. His point is just keep on forgiving. Forgive in an exponential way. It's like the husband who regularly comes home grumpy from work and kind of takes it out on his family or on his wife, and he's just grumpy. And the wife now, it's years down the road, and years ago, you know, your husband might have said, sorry, I'll try to do better, right? I'll try to be better when I come home from work. But it never really changed. He just continues to come home grumpy all the time. And now he pretended like he was trying to do better for a time, but now it's years down the road, and you know it's not going to change. He's just a grumpy guy when he comes home from work. And the usual result of this sort of situation is bitterness. It grows as time goes on. Or manipulation, which is a very common and popular tactic within relationships, especially close relationships, is I'm going to try to manipulate him into being a different person than what he is. And so I'm going to make his life miserable when he's grumpy so that maybe he stops being grumpy. Or we build up walls. And we go, I'm not even going to register that he's grumpy. When he comes home, I'm just going to ignore him for a while until he snaps out of it. We build up these walls between ourselves in relationships. None of those is what we're called to. None of those is what Jesus is talking about here. Instead, his solution is to let it go. Every time. To let it go. Every day he's coming home grumpy from work to let it go. And to every day to choose to love in spite of that. To not build up walls of protection, but to level the walls down and allow that grumpiness to affect you. And in that moment, still to choose to love and serve and let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Now again, this isn't forgetting. Jesus doesn't say to forgive and forget here. We shouldn't forget. In fact, we should remember that to help us love better. That wife in that situation can know, hey, he typically comes home pretty grumpy. Well, how can I meet and serve him in his grumpiness? How can I keep from adding to his pain when he comes home, adding to his load when he comes home? How can I help serve him within that grumpiness? But you can only do that when forgiveness is a part of the picture, when forgiveness is a key part of the picture, where you're just letting it go and letting it go and letting the hurt go over and over and over and over and over again. If you're filling out the handout this morning, you can see if you're on our church platform, which is, by the way, where I'd recommend most everyone go, is to our online platform at gcfrb.com. But in the to your right here, there's a little link there. You can click on handout and get to the handout if you want to print that out and write things down. You can also follow along on the right hand side of the screen with the handout there. But if you're filling out the handout, the point on your handout is don't stop believing. Actually, no, that's not it. That's a Journey song. It's actually don't stop forgiving. Don't stop forgiving. Forgive over and over and over and over and over again. There's a million reasons to stop forgiving. There's a million excuses that we can claim as to why we will stop forgiving someone, especially with repetitious hurts. But none of those are valid, because our call is to just let go, let go, let go, let go. Then he gives us a little bit of a story to kind of illustrate why this is important, to help us understand the importance of this. He says, "For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he had begun to settle with them, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. But since he did not have the means to repay, his Lord commanded him to be sold along with his wife and children and all that he had, and repayment be made." So we have this picture of a king, and he's got some slaves, and he's got one particular slave that he's settling accounts with. And this one particular slave has this debt of 10,000 talents. Now, Jesus is intentionally inflating a crazy number. No one ever would have a debt this large in the first century, because a talent of gold, which was the largest measurement of gold that it was possible, was worth 6,000 denarii. And a denarius represented 1 day's labor, 1 day's wage. So one talent is 6,000 days of work, right? Crazy long time. But he says this guy owes 10,000 talents. That is 60 million days of work. If a person worked every single day, they would have to go for 164,384 years to work this off. 164,384 years to work this off. No way is this guy going to be able to repay this ever. And so the king actually enslaves him, this guy, his wife, and their children, all puts them into slavery. And this was, by the way, this was the right and fair thing to do. This is how things worked in the Roman Empire. There was no bankruptcy in the Roman Empire. There was no getting out of debts that you had. You basically had two options. Either you would go to debtor's prison, which was you'd go to jail until the debt was paid off, or you would be enslaved to that person or sold into slavery to repay your debt. And then you would work off your debt. And once you worked off your debt, then you wouldn't be enslaved anymore. Then you would go free. Well, this guy has such a large debt, he's never going to be able to repay it. His wife's never going to be able to repay it. His kids are never going to be able to repay it. This is generational slavery that is going to happen to this family. His grandkids are not going to be able to repay it. His great-grandkids are not going to be able to repay it. They're all going to be enslaved for generations and generations and generations. It is such a massive debt. And so the slave does the only thing the only option he has at this point. The slave fell to the ground and prostrated himself before him, saying, "Have patience with me, and I will repay you everything." And the Lord of that slave felt compassion and released him and forgave him the debt. So he gets down on the ground and he's bowing before, he's pleading with this king, "Do not do this. I will repay you." Which is a silly statement. Keep in mind, it's going to take 164,384 years to repay this. He cannot repay it. So either the guy doesn't understand how much he owes, he doesn't understand how much that really is, or he doesn't appreciate how long it's going to take to repay that. But the king chooses not even to allow him to repay it. He chooses another route altogether. Out of his compassion for the man, he releases him. He sets him free, and he forgives, he dismisses, he cancels, he lets go of all the debt that this man owes him. This crazy amount of money, which in our time would be about $4.5 billion, he just says, "You're free. The debt's canceled. I let it go." This is amazing. What an amazing act of grace and mercy toward this man who had no other option. He was backed into a corner. Slavery was what was going to happen to this man and his family and for generations and generations. And the king just decides out of his grace and his mercy to let it all go. It's amazing. And if the story stopped there, we would go away from this going, "Wow, what graciousness, what mercy." But that is not the point of this story. The point is what happens next. He says, "But that slave went out and found one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. And he seized him and began to choke him, saying, 'Pay back what you owe.' So his fellow slave fell to the ground and began to plead with him, saying, 'Have patience with me, and I will repay you.' But he was unwilling and went and threw him in prison until he should pay back what he owed." This picture, if it was by itself, would actually, most people in the first century would say, this is actually right and fair. This is actually what the guy should be doing. Because this 100 denarii is not a small sum of money. It's a good chunk of money. Remember, a denarius was 1 day's wages. So this is 100 days' wages. In America today, that would be about $24,000. This is not $50. This is a large amount. And so to go and, you know, if someone owed you $24,000, I don't think anybody would expect you not to want to collect on that. If you had given someone a personal loan for $24,000, it would make sense that you would want them to pay you that back. The problem with this story, the problem with where this lands, is that you place this into the context, and this becomes a ridiculous act. He had just been forgiven, again, about $4.5 billion in today's money. Now, if you had been forgiven $4.5 billion and immediately turned around and been demanding $24,000 from someone else, that's ridiculous. This is ridiculous. Because in the context of the forgiveness he was shown, to not forgive others, whatever they owe him, is pretty ridiculous and unfair. You bring that into real life. The story is illustrating something for us. When someone's wronged you, and maybe someone's wronged you greatly, it's not that you've not been wronged. You have been wronged. It doesn't mean that you haven't been wronged maybe repeatedly. It doesn't mean that you haven't been wronged greatly, enormously, based on what they've done to you, what someone might have done to you. But it is that you have been forgiven. It is that you have been forgiven repeatedly. It is that you have been forgiven greatly, enormously, beyond imagination. You've been forgiven far greater than any wrong that's ever been done to you or ever will be done to you. You've already been forgiven for that. God has let that offense go. So in the context of your life, forgiveness is always the right call. Always. No matter the circumstance, no matter the hurt, no matter the pain, no matter what's been inflicted upon you, forgiveness is always the right call. The story finishes with this. He says, "So when his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were deeply grieved and came and reported to their Lord all that had happened. Then summoning him, his Lord said to him, 'You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you?' And his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed him." He finishes with this: "My heavenly Father will also do the same to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from your heart." Usually we don't forgive because we either don't understand the forgiveness we've been given. Like, we don't understand how great that amount is. And I was trying to find a good illustration for this, but honestly, I could come up with nothing. We just have to understand that we have wronged the God of the universe, the creator of the universe, and that alone, and we've wronged him repeatedly. We were enemies of him. We rejected him. Every single one of us has. And we continue to act in lack of faith and rejection of God when we choose to sin and ignore what he's called us to do, what he's told us is best for our lives. We have so wronged him in such a greater way than we will ever be wronged. But a lot of times we don't understand that. Or maybe we understand that, but we don't appreciate it. We show a lack of appreciation for the forgiveness that's been given to us. Just like this guy seemed to not really appreciate the forgiveness he was shown. No matter which of these reasons is the reason why we don't forgive others, lack of forgiveness is always the wrong call. Always. And so is feigned forgiveness. Like, "Oh, I'm sorry. You know, fine, I'll forgive you because I just don't want to deal with it anymore." Now he says, forgive your brother from your heart, from the core of who you are, real forgiveness. You're truly letting it go. So the point on your handout is this: the citizens of the kingdom of heaven, we forgive up to the amount that you've been forgiven. And that amount is immeasurable. It's an immeasurable amount. And in fact, you can even draw in this little infinity symbol here. It's unlimited. It's infinite. The amount of forgiveness we offer, the number of times we forgive, and also the amount we forgive, which is usually in relationship to the amount of the wrong, right? Like how much someone's wronged us. No one could ever wrong you to such a great degree that it would be more forgiveness than you've been offered. Not even close. The worst thing that's ever been done to you, the worst thing that anyone has ever done to you in comparison to the amount that you've been forgiven is a small amount. And so we always forgive. We always forgive. Now he transitions here. Matthew transitions to a different scene. Jesus goes to a different place. And he begins to talk about something, a subject that seems a little bit different. But I think the reason why Matthew lays this together, Matthew, Matthew's more thematic than it is chronological. And so Matthew was intentionally placing different stories and events together for a purpose. I think the reason why he lays this next event right next to this is that for most of us, the place we can most clearly see unforgiveness on display is within marriage, within our own marriages or within others' marriages, that we see bitterness and resentment like build up over the years, and there's a lack of forgiveness. Oh, he always does that. She always does that. And so he goes immediately into this discussion of marriage and really of divorce, which ultimately comes from a lack of forgiveness, usually. And so it says when Jesus had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, and large crowds followed him there, and he healed them there. So the little change of screen, of scene, but he keeps going. He says, some Pharisees came to Jesus, testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? This was a question that they're bringing to him really for two reasons. One, it was a question that the rabbis had debated for a good couple hundred years at this point. And there was a couple of schools of thought on divorce. Both believed divorce definitely an okay thing to do. And we'll talk about why they believe that here in a second. But it was for what reason could you divorce? And there was different views on that. And so they're coming to Jesus and they're testing him. They're trying to set him up. Because not only was this a touchy question that divided a lot of people, it was kind of an emotional question that really, people really cared a lot about. And there was heated discussions about this particular question. But also, the current ruler in Judea, Herod Antipas, he had just recently divorced his wife. And in fact, John the Baptist, who set up Jesus' ministry, he had been critical of Herod's divorce and he was hooking up with a relative anyway. But he was critical of his divorce and John the Baptist ended up, he's now dead because of that criticism. And so it was kind of a dangerous question to be asking. And Jesus answers it in a very different way than they expected. This is normal for Jesus to do this. They were expecting to go, like, where do you land on this debate? Which side do you land on? And he goes a third direction here. He says this. He says, and as he answered them, he said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. See, the question that they were asking is, they're basically asking, where's the line? Where's the line over which once my marriage has stepped over that line, has gone over that line, that it's okay to divorce? And Jesus actually reels that back and answers it in a very different way than where's the line. See, I've gotten a lot of questions over the years from students about where the line is, and it usually is in regards to their physical relationship with a boyfriend or girlfriend. Like where is the line in a dating relationship physically? And I've had a lot of students come to me and just go, tell us what to do. Tell us what the Bible says, what Jesus says we can and cannot do physically. And I always go a different direction because I think Scripture goes a different direction by saying the question is not where the line is. The question is, what's best for the other person? What's best for the person you're dating? How can you self-sacrificially love them? Love them at your own expense. What would that look like? To do what's best for them. Not even to do what they want to do. Because obviously within a relationship, the physical relationship advances due to passions a lot of the time. But the question is, what's going to be best for her? What's going to be best for him? If we stop dating at some point, what's going to be best for them at that point? And think about those kinds of things and not about the line. And that's the direction Jesus goes with this divorce question. The question is not, when is it okay to divorce? He goes back to the beginning and he says, what is marriage and how did God establish marriage? What is marriage supposed to be? Because what we want to do, and I've also gotten this question a number of times over the years, when is divorce okay? We've grown apart over the years. Is it okay now? We want different things in life. We're going in different directions in life. Is it okay now? What if they told me they don't love me anymore? What if I don't love them anymore? Which, by the way, there's an easy answer to that particular one. Love them. Love is not how you feel about them. Love is a choice to do what's best for them. So begin to choose to love them is the answer to that particular one. Some people would say the spark's not there anymore. The spark we had earlier in our relationship, not there. We just don't talk anymore. We don't communicate anymore. What if we haven't had sex for 6 months or a year? Or it's going on 3 years now. 3 years without sex. 10 years without sex. What if there's sin issues within the relationship? Lust, pornography, anger, lying to one another. Is it okay then? What if that person has changed? He or she, they're not the person I married anymore. They're making me into someone that I don't recognize anymore. Maybe they're not being a good parent to our kids, and my kids need stability. Or I'm just unhappy all the time in this marriage. God wouldn't want me to be unhappy, would he? Or maybe we made a mistake. We got married too young. We didn't even know ourselves. We didn't even know what we wanted. So I need to restart now that I know who I am and know what I want. What if there's health problems, Alzheimer's, persistent coma, cancer, and you just can't deal with it? What if there's substance abuse or verbal abuse or emotional abuse or physical abuse or gross neglect within the relationship, mental illness within the relationship? Isn't there some line that once it's crossed, the divorce is okay? Now hear me on this. All of those things I just listed, those things need to be addressed. Those things should not go unaddressed. They definitely need to be addressed and probably need to be addressed with someone outside of your relationship. But none of those are a reason for divorce. None. In fact, there is the reason why none of those are a reason for divorce is there is no reason for divorce. See, Jesus doesn't go through and kind of give some principles for you can divorce here, you can divorce here. If it's really this way, you can divorce there. And that's what they were talking about, these rabbis were talking about. He just goes back to the beginning and says, this is the way it was established. This is God's plan for marriage. And he had a permanent plan for marriage where one man, one woman would become one person, which, by the way, only God can do that kind of math. Where one and one actually equals one. And once God has made one plus one one, that never again would two enter into the picture, ever enter into the picture. They would always be one. And to make one back into two is actually man undoing what God has done. And if we don't understand how dangerous that is, how wrong that is to undo what God has done, then we're missing it. So then, you know, these guys are listening to this and they're not convinced. So what they do is they say this. They said to him, when then did Moses command or why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? All right, now we're coming in with the obscure Bible passage. Again, in my experience, when I've talked to people about this issue, People want to pull in obscure Bible passages. That's what they're doing here, by the way. A very obscure Bible passage they're throwing in here. And it's from Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but I'm going to tell you what it's about. You can read it later if you'd like. But this passage is addressing specifically the issue, one issue. And this issue is this. A husband and wife marry. He divorces the wife. The wife remarries. Her husband dies. And she wants to remarry the first husband. No, you can't do that, is what Moses commanded them. But within all of that, which, by the way, does not have anything to do with where the line is on divorce. Nothing to do with that. But within that obscure passage, they pull out this phrase that says, he writes her a certificate of divorce. Which is not at all Moses' point. It's not at all what he's talking about. They just took that phrase and they said, look, Moses, and they actually used the word commands. Moses commands divorce. And in fact, it's crazy. This is the only passage that even refers to divorce. And all of the rabbis at that time, no one disagreed on whether you could divorce. You totally could divorce. The only question was how and why and what circumstances you could. And the only reason they came down on that was this one passage. So obscure. But it hasn't changed. This tactic, it still goes on today. You can read books, you can read articles about divorce, and people will pull out these random passages that will, I've heard people talk about Jesus saying to his disciples, when you're ministering in this city and they persecute you, flee to another city. And so, if you're persecuted in marriage, flee. Come on, really? Passages like 1 Corinthians chapter 5 that talk about not associating with anyone who is an unbeliever or a drunkard or a swindler. My husband drinks, so I can't associate with him. Divorce. Really? Is that what he's talking about there? Galatians 6:7 says, you reap what you sow. So if you reap difficulty within your marriage, or if you sow difficulty into your marriage, you should reap me wanting to divorce you. And it should be okay. And some actually still refer to this Deuteronomy 24 passage, in fact. There's whole theologies based on this verse, completely out of context, that refers to the fact that you can write her a certificate of divorce if you detect some indecency in her. And so they study this word indecency and they go, okay, indecency means that you can divorce under this circumstance and this circumstance and this circumstance and this circumstance. And all of that directly is in contradiction to Jesus' very, 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 very clear words here. I don't think Jesus could have been more clear. And so, in fact, he actually says this to them regarding this Deuteronomy 24 passage. He says to them, because of the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it has not been this way. It's like, yeah, sure, in that circumstance, Moses wasn't going to stop divorce. Because you were going to divorce her anyway. You're going to send her away. But we just needed to make it legal. So let's get a certificate going and, you know, let's do it that way. But from the beginning, God's intention for marriage from the very beginning was a permanent relationship that is never separated. And so with all of this in mind, his next statement actually is very logical. He says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. It is adultery for two people who are married to divorce one another, to remarry someone else. And the idea is you're going to obviously have sex with that person, right? That is adultery. Because you've separated and remarried. And sure, yeah, it's legal, right? There's a legal document that says divorce has occurred. There's a legal document that says marriage has reoccurred. But from God's perspective, he's not concerned about the legal. He's concerned about what marriage really is, which has nothing to do with the marriage certificate you got from the state. It has to do with what God has done, which is he's brought two together, made them one. So to separate that so that you can be with someone else, it's adultery. Don't do it is his point. Don't do it. Don't put a legal stamp on this sin. And the only reason why he says, except for immorality, and a lot of times people would say this is like an exception. It's not an exception. Immorality is doing just what we just talked about. It's when, if you have sex outside of your oneness relationship, you are separating what God has brought together. That's what you're doing. And you are coming together in oneness with someone else. You've already separated what God has brought together. You've already done that. The point of all of this, and please just hear Jesus' words clearly here, because I don't think he could have been more clear. Marriage is permanent. Marriage is permanent. You might be thinking at this point, if that's the way it is, and by the way, that is the way it is, right? We saw that Jesus is being clear. That's hard. Yeah, I agree. That's scary. Yeah, I agree. You're opening yourself up to a permanent relationship in which marriage could put you in a really tough spot. This kind of commitment to marriage could put you in a really tough spot. Yeah, it could. And if you're single, you might be thinking, I've always thought that marriage was the path for my life, but maybe I need to rethink that now. And honestly, I think it would be wise to count the cost here, to understand what you're getting into. And that's exactly what how these disciples respond. If we have any question about whether the disciples understood Jesus' words here, this makes it very, very clear. The disciples said to him, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. Most of these guys were still single. They're like, if this is the way that it is, and they weren't doubting that this is the way that it is, they're saying Jesus is being clear, right? This is the way it is. It seems like it might be better not to marry. Not to put yourself in that position where you're committed to that person for life. And maybe you're in marriage now and you're thinking, I didn't realize that's what I signed up for. It is what you signed up for. It is what occurred. God put you in a permanent oneness relationship with that other person. Which, by the way, is a side note. If divorce is a part of your story from the past and you are now remarried to someone else, this is a reality for your current marriage. God has put that together. You are in a oneness relationship in your current marriage. So this is a permanent relationship. And so they go, maybe it's better not to marry. And Jesus says this, he says, but he said to them, not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. And there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it. So there's a lot in here. He's basically just saying one main thing here. But he's talking about eunuchs. In response to this, a eunuch at its base level, a eunuch is just someone who's committed to singleness, who's committed to probably lifelong singleness. And you know, in that time, in that place, sometimes that was due to some physical thing that was going on. Sometimes that was a choice you made in order to serve in a certain vocation. Sometimes it was a vocation that was forced on you, so you were forced to be single if you were in that vocation. He also says that there's some for the kingdom of heaven who have chose singleness in order to be more effective for the kingdom. And good for you if that's your choice. You might choose singleness, and that's perfectly fine, especially when you see the weight of what marriage is. And he says some will accept it, which basically means some will take hold of it, will still go in that direction knowing the weightiness of what marriage is. Some will still choose marriage. And some will look at the weightiness of that and they'll go, I'm not going to choose marriage. I'm going to choose to be single. I'm going to choose not to put myself in that position of that sort of a permanent commitment. And he said, that's fine too. Some will accept it, some won't accept it. Both are fine. So the point of your handout is knowing the gravity of a marriage commitment, your best path might be singleness. Might be. That might be what God's calling you to in your life, knowing the permanence of this. But this is the reality of it. That's what he wants us to understand, is this is the reality of what God has created. God is the author of marriage. He is the one who created this thing that we call marriage. And marriage was created to be an inseparable bond between two people for life. That is what it is. And regardless of, some would say, yeah, it's an inseparable bond for life, except when the ideal doesn't happen. No. Even when the ideal doesn't happen, it's an inseparable bond for life. Couple questions just to end on this morning. Things for you to think about if you're alone watching this, or maybe you can discuss it as a family if you're with your family, or if you're on our Zoom fellowship groups, which by the way, I would plug again, if you haven't been a part of those, they're great. It's been really fun to be together on that platform. You can click on even right now in the upper right hand corner of the screen, there's a connect button. Hit connect and you'll get on to our Zoom groups, and be able to discuss this question, or these questions. But, this first one is really for self-reflection. I don't think it's something that you really need to share amongst your group, but who do you need to forgive? Think about that just for a second. Is there someone in your life that you need to forgive, that you need to let go of the hurt that they caused you? And then what kinds of people are hard for you to forgive? This is a good thing to discuss. What situations, what type of hurts that people do to you make it harder for you to let go of that thing? And then what's hard about Jesus' teaching on the permanence of marriage? And what's helpful? So I think there's a great help. I know from my own experience, there's a great help. There's been a great help in mine and Melissa's marriage to know from the beginning, separating was never an option for either one of us. And it has been a great strength to our marriage. But what's hard about that idea, and what's helpful? So discuss those things. We'll be back again next Sunday together here digitally. And I just pray that you have a great week this week.